Well, I think one thing we're going to do right out of the gate is define what pro-life is.
Scott Klusendorf talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That term is now being confused. It's being put up for grabs, and we're going to make clear what the pro-life syllogism is, how we can make that case for life with people who don't accept biblical authority, who maybe don't even know what it is we stand for, and are subject to being confused. So there's a crying need to clarify what pro-life means, what our actual arguments are, and then we'll look at five bad ways people argue against the pro-life case in the public square so that we can be prepared to give good, solid, Christ-honoring answers.
You can meet and hear Scott Klusendorf making the case for life at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Learn more about conference speakers and topics and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. On this Thursday, May the 17th, we're going to take some time to talk about a big story from the New York Times, big not only in its volume, but also perhaps in its import. It is the New York Times' attempt to, front-load some of the framework for what is doubtless going to be a bigger story, and that is the release of the Investigator General's report from the FBI. This thing is coming out. People want to know what it says. Some people apparently already seem to know some of what it has to say. We're going to talk about the New York Times coverage of the FBI surveillance of the Donald Trump campaign. Joining us to do so, Molly Hemingway, a regular guest, a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and author of a recent column there titled 10 Key Takeaways from the New York Times' error-ridden defense of FBI spying on Trump campaign. Molly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's great to be here with you.
What does this recent story in the New York Times tell you about the forthcoming Inspector General's report?
Yeah, well, Washington, D.C. is a town that is built around leaks of information, and it's good to think through why something is being leaked. So yesterday, the New York Times reported that there was a much larger investigation of the Trump campaign than had previously been known, and it was based on leaks of information from high-level Department of Justice sources. And so what it tells us is that these people are almost certainly preparing for the release of the FBI's Inspector General's report on how the FBI was handling investigation of the Clinton campaign and the Trump campaign, trying to kind of get ahead of that story so that they can explain their actions in the kindest possible way with friendly reporters at a friendly media outlet. Because what we learned from this story was that the FBI was spying on the Trump campaign, and that's a really incendiary and pretty shocking thing to learn. But the way the New York Times couched it was as gentle as could possibly be explained.
So this is just kind of stunning for the admission to be made, and other people who had their suspicions. How exactly does the New York Times put it? I mean, how do you say FBI spying on a presidential campaign in a way that makes it sound like, well, come on, this happens every day?
Well, we had already learned that they'd wiretapped a Trump campaign affiliate. That person was Carter Page. That information came out in a very difficult fashion with a lot of investigation, that they had secured a wiretap against a Trump campaign affiliate and they had renewed it three times. So we kind of already knew this was the case, but their claim was, well, this guy had left the campaign and we had other reason to believe that he needed to be spied on. It turned out not to be true, but that they needed to spy on him. But what this came out yesterday was that it wasn't just Carter Page. It was four Trump campaign affiliates. It includes Paul Manafort, which is probably not surprising, George Papadopoulos, who supposedly had something to do with the launch of the investigation, and even Michael Flynn. That was Donald Trump's top foreign policy advisor and future national security advisor. And it looks like he was investigated simply for giving a speech in Russia to a Russia-sponsored media outlet. And this, you know, it is stunning to learn that the FBI was spying on American citizens who were so involved with a presidential campaign. And previously, this had been, by and large, denied by the FBI. or they made it sound like it was crazy to think that such a thing would have happened. And many people in the media mocked the idea that the Obama administration was spying on the Trump campaign. And here we have, in the New York Times itself, people now saying, sure, yeah, we weren't just spying. This wasn't just wiretaps. We also used national security letters, which are a secret way to get information from people. And they also used at least one human intelligence source. So, you know, a literal spy sent into a campaign to collect information. This is big news.
We've heard all along that whatever kind of snooping there might have been into the Trump campaign was based upon credible reports or credible suspicion that there was collusion of some kind. I wonder what that word even means now with the Russians. Any evidence of that in the latest coverage?
Yeah, so we're a year. Today is actually the year anniversary of the launch of the special counsel, which was set up to investigate supposed treasonous collusion between Trump and Russia. But it's really as close to the second anniversary of this investigation, which is sprawling. It has limitless funds. It can go anywhere it wants. And we have literally zero evidence to support the claim of treasonous collusion with Russia. And even more than that, we have a lot of evidence that the supposed, we have a lot of reason to believe that the supposed evidence that launched everything was actually pretty fishy to begin with. We're learning that a lot of the information was gained through setups, meetings that were themselves setups by, it looks like, either our government or other government officials, that the claims of things that needed to be investigated actually didn't necessarily need to be investigated. It's actually not a crime to visit Russia. It's not a crime to even have a different foreign policy view than the bipartisan elite consensus in Washington, D.C. And to make the case that this really needed to be done, I think there are a lot of questions that have to be answered. And I think that a lot of people are going to start demanding to find out what protocols were followed. There is guidance in the FBI about launching investigations on political opponents, and I'm really curious to find out who signed off on this, who knew what when, who approved it, and whether those protocols were followed. It's not looking terribly good on that score.
Just as a note here, where in the New York Times story did the revelation that to date there is no evidence of collusion, where did that appear?
It's really interesting. In the 69th paragraph of the 4,000-word story, the New York Times kind of criticizes itself over a story that came out just before the 2016 election. That story looks like it was a leak designed to let people know that the FBI had launched an investigation on Trump, but instead the headline kind of did the opposite. The headline said that the FBI had found no evidence of collusion with Russia, and then in the 10th paragraph, it kind of conceded that an investigation had been opened. So in this story, in the New York Times, they're criticizing, they say they buried the lead. The real point of that story was supposed to be that an investigation was launched. So it was kind of funny that in the 70th paragraph of yesterday's New York Times story, it admits that after 2 years of digging, there is still no evidence of collusion with Russia or any involvement by any member of the Trump campaign or any affiliate with any of the Russian supposed election meddling. But that was buried in the 70th paragraph of a story that tells us all about this widespread spying, use of the intelligence apparatus to spy on the Trump campaign.
That has to be one of the most egregious incidents of burying the lead. That's the whole point, isn't it?
Well, in this case, I think that the actual point of the story was to justify, defend, and contextualize everything that the FBI was doing. So they had to bury the lead. They had to, like, if you begin by pointing out that we've been told about treasonous collusion with Russia for 2 years, and maybe the entire story is kind of an hoax or in kind of information operation, that would destroy the premise of the piece, which is that really, these FBI agents were doing their very, very best to do everything on the up and up. And on that note, I just want to say that the story used a quote from Sally Yates to make you feel better that everything in this operation was done on the up and up. Sally Yates was a highly partisan political appointee who actually tried to claim that Mike Flynn violated something called the Logan Act, which is a archaic and unconstitutional law that limits Americans' free speech rights. But she used this as a means to further an investigation into Mike Flynn and try and ring him up on lying to the FBI. But she is the person who's used to substantiate the claim that the FBI did everything on the up and up. In order to take her quote seriously, you have to know literally nothing about her or her work history.
What is this about a top secret government informant?
So this is actually, to me, one of the most interesting things about this story in recent days. A couple weeks ago, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence subpoenaed the FBI and Department of Justice for information. They said nothing about the publicly about what information they sought. But the Department of Justice responded extremely negatively. Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, said that their push to get these documents amounted to extortion of the Department of Justice, as if congressional oversight, which is completely the appropriate purview of an oversight committee, is extortion. Then they started running a public relations campaign against Devin Nunes, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence chairman, as well as his staff. But they also started leaking to media outlets about what was sought. They said they couldn't share this information with Congress because it was so sensitive that it would risk someone's life. And yet at the same time, they told the Washington Post personally identifying biographical and professional details about the individual who we're led to believe is the person that about for whom information is being sought. They said that he worked with the CIA and FBI, that he had ties to British intelligence, that he was an American citizen. That's what they told the Washington Post. In yesterday's New York Times story, they revealed additional details, assuming it's the same spy working on the Trump campaign. They say that this person met with two of the surveilled Trump affiliates, Carter Page and George Papadopoulos. So they're giving a lot of information to friendly media reporters, but they're saying they can't give that information to Congress because it's so sensitive that it would risk someone's life. And that is a very difficult circle to square, given their own behavior and their own lack of carefulness about this information.
Molly Hemingway is our guest. We're talking about the New York Times coverage recently of the FBI surveillance of the Trump campaign. When we come back, she says there's some ignorance of basic facts. We'll outline that right after this.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Jonathan Fisk is the author of our book of the month for May, Echo, Unbroken Truth Worth Repeating Again. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Echo by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Echo, Unbroken Truth Worth Repeating Again, by Pastor Jonathan Fisk.
40 years greatly blessed is this year's theme at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment and provide an alternative to secular public high schools. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a special 40th anniversary tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During May, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to Concordia Theological Seminary. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org.
Cradled in historic Perry County, Missouri, the manger of the Missouri Synod, Emmanuel Lutheran Church at 453 Northwest Street in Perryville proclaims God's Word and celebrates His Supper on Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 7:30 and 10 using the church's liturgy contained in Lutheran Service Book, enriched with ancient and modern hymns. For more information, call 573-547-8317 or visit www.emmanuel-perryville.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the New York Times coverage of the FBI surveillance of the Trump campaign. Molly Hemingway is our guest, a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and author of a recent column titled 10 Key Takeaways from the New York Times Error-Ridden Defense of FBI Spying on Trump Campaign. The Issues Etc. Making the Case conference is the premier conference for Christian laity. That's why we have the conference on Fridays and Saturdays. It begins with a live broadcast Friday afternoon at 3 and ends with the Divine Service Saturday night at 5:30 at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois. We've kind of tailored that schedule around the layperson's responsibilities and schedule as well. This year's conference speakers include Hank Hanegraaff, Scott Klusendorf, Will Wheaton, Hans Feeney, Jonathan Fisk, Angus Manouge, and Craig Parton. Attendance for the conference is limited to 400. Thanks to the Lutheran Church Extension Fund, child care is free. You can learn more about the conference and you can register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. It's the 2018 Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Molly, in addition to the criticisms you've already leveled here at the New York Times piece, you say that there is an ignorance of basic facts in the story. How would you outline that for us?
Just one of the frustrations as someone who has been covering this story quite a bit, that sometimes people write about this story without knowing basic facts. Literally, the second sentence includes Nair. It says, "We've never seen before reported Peter Strzok, the FBI agent who was involved in both the Clinton email investigation and the Trump investigation, was sent to London to meet with the Australian ambassador." Well, that's been actually pretty well known. They also say that there was no publication of this Russian dossier's reports or the FBI's interest in those reports until after Election Day. That is not just untrue, it's like fantastically untrue. There was the September Yahoo News story that had the headline, "U.S. intelligence officials probe ties between Trump advisor and the Kremlin." That was such a big story that it was actually used to secure a wiretap against one of the Trump affiliates, or it was mentioned in the wiretap application. There was also the October 31st story headlined, "A veteran spy has given the FBI information alleging a Russian operation to cultivate Donald Trump." Both of those stories were sourced pretty much completely to the foreign agent that was writing these documents. It mischaracterized things like how eager Peter Strzok was to look into the Trump campaign allegations. In the New York Times account, they say that he was very reticent and he wasn't eager at all. Well, the text that they quote literally begins with an expletive that I won't mention, and it says, in all caps, "I cannot believe we are seriously looking at these allegations and the pervasive connections." He also said, and another expletive, "This feels momentous because this matters. The other one did too," meaning the Clinton email investigation, "but that was to ensure that we didn't expletive something up. This matters because this matters," in all caps. That's a guy who's actually quite eager. They also mischaracterized whether Page, one of these Trump campaign affiliates, had successfully been recruited by Russian spies. In fact, he was not successfully recruited, and he talked to the FBI about the attempt to recruit him. The agents who tried to recruit him were arrested or kicked out of the country. And then it repeated long debunked claims about the Republican Party platform supposedly changing to become more Putin friendly. And it also said that Mr. Comey met with President Trump to tell him all about these Steele reports. Comey recently went on a media tour where he told multiple journalists that he told Donald Trump next to nothing about the Steele reports, only that one single, most salacious claim in the dossier. So it just, I could go on and on. There were so many errors in this story. It just makes it hard to take it seriously when the reporters covering it don't know basic facts about the FBI investigation.
So talk a little bit about this text from Peter Strzok to someone where he mentions this investigation or parts of it as an insurance policy.
Right. So texts have been out now for many months between Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. These are two FBI or Department of Justice officials who are allegedly having an affair, and they talked nonstop about the investigation into Trump as well as other matters. One of the things he specifically said was that something about this being an insurance policy. He says it in reference to the possibility that Donald Trump is elected president and how we can't afford to take that risk. The article says, you know, Trump has always felt that that meant that they were looking for an insurance policy in the case that Donald Trump was elected, which is a fair reading of it. And they say, nothing could be further from the truth. He actually was not even assuming that Trump would be elected, and his behavior was really based on that assumption that Trump wouldn't be elected. Well, I wonder if reporters actually understand how insurance policies work. The whole point of an insurance policy is that you can't afford a catastrophic but unlikely event taking place, so you insure against that possibility. But the reporters didn't seem to understand that.
Talk a little bit about kind of the nuanced language in the New York Times piece when it came to the actual spying, snooping, surveilling, eavesdropping, wiretapping.
Right. I think about this time I served on a jury, and the defense attorney was so great. I thought, if I'm ever accused of a crime, I would like this defense attorney representing me. I kind of feel that way about the New York Times as they handled this explosive news that the Trump campaign was spied on by the FBI. But they make it sound almost like a pleasant experience. They say, prosecutors obtained court approval to eavesdrop on Mr. Page. Well, I mean, when you put it that way, it just sounds like, what's the big deal? It also says that when Comey pulled Donald Trump aside and told him that they had this, like, incredibly salacious, compromising information on him, that he was worried that this would be interpreted as a J. Edgar Hoover type situation. That's the FBI head who used to use compromising information to control his political opponents and to increase his power. Now, if I were a reporter who was told this by James Comey, I'd be asking, well, if you didn't want to give the impression of a J. Edgar Hoover situation, why are you doing literally the most J. Edgar Hoover thing anyone has ever heard of? You know, how do you explain why you did this, why you kept information about the whole, all these Russia reports and all the claims of what was happening with the campaign from the president, unless you were trying to be like J. Edgar Hoover? They also said, you know, this was a real apolitical operation. They kept details from political appointees, but then they quote political appointees like Sally Yates saying, well, no, everything was done by the book. So it just was a very friendly way of trusting everything the FBI agents said about how they handled the Clinton investigation in such an above board manner, despite the fact that they exonerated her, even though she mishandled classified information. And despite the fact that they days later launched an investigation into the opposing political party of the current president and sent spies into his campaign.
So a couple final questions for you. Is there any connection, since this took place, these Justice Department actions took place in the waning days of the Obama administration, is there any connection forthcoming between what the FBI was doing and then President Obama himself?
So a lot of the focus of people trying to find out what happened with the use of U.S. intelligence apparatus against the Trump campaign has focused on the FBI. There's a lot of reason to believe it went well beyond the FBI, including that the CIA director, John Brennan, has sort of bragged that he's the one who brought the information in that started the investigation. The CIA director also briefed Harry Reid on the matter with the understanding that he would leak that to the media and also try and pressure Comey to ramp up the investigation. We know that Clapper, the director of national intelligence, was involved, and he gave contradictory testimony about his leaks to CNN about the dossier during the Obama administration. We've learned also recently that multiple people dispute Brennan's claim that the dossier wasn't used to create the narrative of Russia collusion. The former intel chief, Mike Rogers, has sent a letter to congressional overseers saying that it was used and that it was even used to brief President Obama as part of his daily presidential briefing. We also have texts between Strzok and Page saying that POTUS, President of the United States, wanted to know everything about what was going on. We have other evidence that he was briefed about the Russia operation, that the White House wanted to sort of control that investigation. So we have just hit the very tip of the iceberg in terms of knowing who knew what, when, how that information was used, weaponized, what was done by the previous administration. And it just reminds me that about over a year ago, Donald Trump got into a lot of trouble because he said that Obama had wiretapped Trump Tower. He said a bunch of other things about Obama wiretapping the Trump campaign. Now, there is no evidence as of yet that there was a literal wiretap in Trump Tower. But now we have even the New York Times and FBI admitting that there was widespread surveillance on the Trump campaign. People kind of mocked President Trump when he made these claims, and it's not completely wrong because he didn't have evidence to support some of the claims he was making. But as far as the question of whether the Obama administration was spying on the Trump campaign, it's pretty conclusive. It's in the New York Times. It's the FBI admitting it. Yep, they did. They did it in a widespread fashion. They did it using human intelligence, wiretaps, national security letters, and who knows what else. Like, that's just what we've been allowed to learn thus far. And this is something that, in general, Americans, regardless of how they feel about a president or a political candidate, should be very wary about using the intelligence apparatus to spy on political opponents. That's something you expect to see in Russia or a third world country or some kind of banana republic. It's not what we want in this country where we practice rule of law, where we're very careful to not criminalize political differences.
If the Mueller investigation isn't completed by the midterm elections, and there is no end in sight as far as anybody can tell, who benefits more at the midterms, Republicans or Democrats?
I don't know. That's actually a good question, but I really don't know the answer. I have this theory that Donald Trump might not even mind what's going on in the Mueller investigation. It's very counterintuitive since everyone assumes that he hates what's going on. But I think what has been clear as it has progressed is that there's really no evidence of Russia collusion. It reinforces a narrative that helps President Trump, that he's battling the swamp and that they are using the deep state to go against him. On the other hand, the Mueller investigation is the great hope of the resistance. And so long as they can believe that maybe some way what happened in November 2016 can be reversed through the use of a special counsel, they will be very excited by that too. So I think it sort of serves both political arms at this point, and that Mueller, you know, you would hope that he would have kind of quickly figured out that there were some problems to look at in terms of how the FBI handled its investigation. There is no indication from any of the tons of leaks we've gotten from the special counsel that he has moved in that direction. And in fact, his background is so much as, you know, head of the FBI and a longtime Department of Justice official, that he might not be the best person to root out corruption in the Department of Justice or FBI. But having said that, we don't know, and we don't yet know what he plans to do. So everyone is somewhat flying blind in terms of what will come out of this major, major story.
Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and author of a recent column titled 10 Key Takeaways from the New York Times Error-Ridden Defense of FBI Spying on Trump Campaign. You can read her columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. And you can follow Molly on Twitter at MZHemingway. Molly, thanks.
Thank you.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be spending some time with our listeners via our email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. We'll respond to your email and your comments right after this.
In the days of the Reformation, Lutherans insisted that justification is the doctrine on which the church stands or falls. But is this still the case?
Pastor Hans Feeney talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
in a world of moral anarchy, is discussing how man is justified still the most important conversation we need to have? The answer is yes, because we'll never regain a proper understanding of marriage or human identity or even morality itself until we first understand what it means to be made right with God through faith in Jesus Christ.
You can meet and hear Pastor Hans Feeney making the case for the centrality of justification at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. You'll find registration information at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Children are a gift from God, a rich heritage, a precious trust. They are sinners, baptized saints, little brothers and sisters in Christ. It is this beautiful vision that shapes our daily work as parents and grandparents, teachers, pastors, mentors, and friends. And it's this vision you'll see shining through every article in this month's Lutheran Witness magazine, The Gift of Children. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.